KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. What do you know about dinosaurs? Science writer Brian Switek takes us on the road in search of the latest information later this hour. And in our radio retrospective, Katie Sewell considers what different actors brought to ongoing roles like the Lone Ranger. This week, the Obama administration has proposed a series of reforms that are designed to crack down on something called patent trolls. Sean O'Connor is a law professor at George Washington University, and he joins us now in an effort to walk us through the problem and potential solutions. Good morning.
Hi, Marcy.
I understand the official term for patent troll is patent acquisition entity.
Well, there's a few names for it. There's non-practicing entity. There's patent assertion entity. And a few others.
What?
The challenge is that the names are trying to capture different kinds of activities. So basically, they all revolve around the notion of whether someone is actually manufacturing products, and then if they're not doing so, whether they seem to be improperly using patents against people who are manufacturing and selling products.
So essentially, the term patent troll is a pejorative given to somebody that is the sort of scooping up and patents and filing suits?
Yes, it goes back a number of years, and the sense of it was like the mythological troll that hides underneath the bridge and then surprises you and makes you pay something. The challenge with it is that if it was a legitimately granted patent, then you know the original inventor is trying to make some money off that, and there's no reason why the original inventor can't sell the patents later. So the challenge is, you know, who uses it downstream? And are they doing something improper? But again, if it was a legitimate patent, then we don't want to invalidate it.
If you acquire a patent from the U.S. Patent Office, are you legally obligated to use that patent?
No, in the U.S., we do not have what's called a working requirement. Some countries have that, where once you've gotten a patent, you have to use it. In the U.S., we don't. The only exception is if you had federal funding for the invention. Then under the Bayh-Dole Act, you do have to commercialize. But for any other patent, you do not have to actually use it.
So what has the Obama administration proposed in sort of general lay terms?
Well, they're trying to get to the nub of the issues that we don't like. So again, if it's a legitimate inventor or it's a research organization or a university, these are non-practicing entities because they don't manufacture products. We don't want to make their life more difficult. If they have legitimate patents, they should be able to license those and enforce them. So what the Obama administration is trying to do is go after a few things. One is that there's a sense that the bad trolls are using shell companies to basically hide one operation behind a lot of different fronts to confuse people who are being sued. And so the Obama administration wants a real party interest to be the rule, meaning that whoever ends up owning that patent has to disclose their ownership to the patent office and name who the controlling party really is.
Why would
they also want?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So they also want to tighten up what they call functional claiming. And the real challenge here is the patents that people are most concerned about are business methods and software patents. Business methods are things where you have a new way of doing business, not necessarily implicated in a technology. And so you can then prevent people from using that business method. Software, we all know what that is. Both of these kinds of patents seem to be most susceptible to broad claims. They basically talk about the function of what it does without giving an actual practical application, a real kind of tangible, concrete process.
And I know that Microsoft, which is our biggest software company here in the Pacific Northwest, has expressed some uneasiness about these reforms, if not outright opposition. If you have a legitimate reason to have a patent, why would this bother you, these reforms?
Well, the challenge is that if you are trying to claim you know, the actual software that you're doing, then if the patent office starts essentially second-guessing those, then it's going to change the business models that a lot of major companies have been doing their research and development around. And so the concern is that we're going to change the game midstream here, and a lot of legitimate companies are going to get caught up in an effort to capture sort of fringe players, and that these efforts won't really capture those fringe players in the end at all.
Is the primary goal of a holding organization that would be labeled a patent troll to make just to make money? That is it?
No, actually, many of the entities that are putting together patent portfolios are actually trying to create a market in intellectual property. The challenge is, well, it's actually a good thing. We have a lot of innovation in this country, and there's more and more patents, more and more inventions going on. Many of these are great things, but they're small parts of one product that will eventually be manufactured and sold. And so what we really need is the ability to bring together all those different pieces to allow a company that is going to manufacture to get all the rights to do it and to put it out there. So we need an effective IP market. And so a lot of the companies bringing together different pieces of IP, buying them up from inventors and university and whatnot, are putting together very valuable portfolios that then allow manufacturers to distribute and sell products.
What's the difference between this and a move to sort of copyright ideas? Because there's been concern about, with the rise of the internet, of people taking your intellectual property.
Well, you know, you've actually hit the nail on the head there. On both the copyright and the patent side, what we really have is a concern is that if the PTO is allowing things that are too abstract, or if on the copyright side people are trying to enforce copyrights that are really about ideas, mm-hmm. not actual things in the world, then we cut off the ability of people to innovate. Okay, so if you get something that's too abstract, you've covered too many things that we need to be able to use. And so that's really the problem here, is how do we decide what level is too abstract, is too much of just kind of a raw idea and not actually a product or a service?
We're talking with George Washington University law professor Sean O'Connor about the Obama administration's efforts to crack down on patent trolling, or to reform the patent office itself, and how we license things. And I think as we move more towards an economy of ideas and away from making tangible goods like cars or stoves, this is increasingly a question, isn't it? You know, how do
yeah.
who owns what?
Right. I want to just mention one thing, Marcy. I'm actually normally in your backyard. I'm a University of Washington professor. I'm only at George Washington for this year.
Ah, well, thank you. I was misinformed. Well, we're delighted then. One of our own. Okay.
I have hometown loyalty.
Oh, absolutely.
So the issue is that we are getting more and more sort of abstract products and services, especially in the web 2.0 economy. And
right.
So this is what we're really grappling with. You have an idea for something that becomes Facebook. You have an idea for other kinds of social media. Where is the line between, gee, that's a cool idea I had in my head, and something that is completely fleshed out and actually works on the Internet, has all the code done, and can actually be deployed? And that's what we're really grappling with.
How likely are these proposals from the Obama administration to be implemented?
Well, I think that the Obama administration, as the head of the executive branch, can direct the PTO, and they apparently have, to have the examiners examine more closely business method and software patents to make sure that the functions that are being claimed are a little further down that spectrum we just talked about. So they are much more sort of tangible things that can be deployed rather than ideas. They can also have the PTO demand that anyone who is going to be suing and enforcing patents to disclose who they're really owned by and who is the real party in interest. So they can do that, and they can do some study, and they can try to get Congress to do some things. But ultimately, this is going to go back to Congress to have to fix this for real.
As I understand it, we're talking about tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of patent applications. Does the patent office have the personnel to do that kind of scrutiny?
Well, no, that's been one of the challenges. And part of the battle going into the patent reform, the AIA, was to allow the patent office to keep more of its fees, to charge its fees quite appropriately to do its services. But in the past, those were diverted to other uses within the government. So the PTO is trying to keep those fees. At the same time, they got hit by the sequester a bit as well. Mm-hmm. And so now you have this challenge that innovation is more important than ever. We have, as you mentioned, a huge deluge of patent applications coming in. We need lots of examiners to be able to be on this. And if we don't get that, then this problem is only going to get worse.
Is this something that we heard Microsoft sort of feel uneasy about it? Other companies are expressing similar, maybe not qualms, but they say, yeah, good idea. We need to reform this. And then, but we don't want you to do this, this, and this. Are industries likely to contribute or inhibit reform of the patent laws?
The interesting part here is there's not a lot that the private sector can do about executive branch activity.
Huh.
But they can and certainly will be lobbying Congress to the extent that Congress may want to do some amendments to AIA. Now, at the same time, it's hard once you've gone through a major reform effort like the AIA. There's a little bit of burnout in Congress over that issue. You know, that issue is done. We want to move on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what everyone is closely watching is, as you said, you know, these might be great ideas, but it's always about the details. And so everyone's going to watch quite closely to say, okay, yeah, broad claims can be bad, but if we tighten it up too much and narrow it down too much, you know, our patents really aren't worth anything. And big companies that have legitimate reasons to have their patents held in some affiliate organization are concerned that they're going to have some onerous disclosure requirements about their corporate structure that may or may not really be that useful.
Sean O'Connor, thanks for talking with us.
Yes, to do so.
Sean O'Connor is a professor of law at the University of Washington, a visiting professor of law at George Washington University Law School. If you want to hear more about this, you can check out the recent segment that ran on This American Life about patent trolls, and there was an update that ran last week on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
We've been studying them a long time, but we're still learning new things about dinosaurs. That's next.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival, presenting Our 11th Hour, straight talk on climate change from people who know. June 15th at Seattle Rep, with climate scientists Kevin Trenberth and Richard Alley, and journalist Andrew Revkin. Performance by Seattle Opera. More at seattlesciencefestival.org.
66 and sunny in Seattle. The sun will be with us all day. Shows like The Shadow and The Lone Ranger had long runs during radio's golden age. Now, if the actor playing the title role quit or was fired, the bosses simply hired someone else to play the part. So who played it better? We'll compare and contrast different actors playing the same role in 20 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. Life on Earth is and has been incredible. Creatures that have run, soared, slithered, paddled, pulsed, gyrated across water, sea, and sky captivate our imaginations. Continuing research brings new data to light, new theories to prove or disprove, new fossils to study. From very old bones, new pictures of the Earth then, now, and in the future are emerging. Brian Switek is a science writer. His interest, his passion, turned him into a blogger first, then an author of the critically acclaimed book Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. He writes the blog Laylaps at National Geographic Now and wrote at the Smithsonian's Dinosaur Tracking blog. He's written for Slate, The Wall Street Journal, Nature, Scientific American, and many more. His new book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs, has just been published. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And when not writing, he's a volunteer at the Natural History Museum of Utah at Salt Lake City, where he gets the opportunity to hunt for fossils in the field at Dinosaur National Monument, Escalante National Monument, or Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. So when last you were in the field, what did you come upon?
Yeah, it was just a few days ago, actually. I still have my blisters and bug bites from my last foray out into the field. And I didn't get a chance to actually come upon very much. This wasn't so much a prospecting trip as an excavation trip. So there was already a dinosaur that was in the ground that is one of these shovel-beaked herbivorous hadrosaurs, so about 30-foot-long animal, lived about 75 million years ago. some of the skeleton had come out. There are actually skin impressions from this animal, and somebody found a skull bone. So this is a great joy of paleontology, a skull bone. We actually have part of the head. And then you're like, oh, geez, like, look at all that rock that we now have to pick and shovel through. So I spent about 2.5 days picking and shoveling and sweeping out this quarry, and we found some more bones. I, unfortunately, was in the wrong spot in the quarry to find any more than fragments, but the people just to the left of me found more of the arm bones, a few more skull bones. So, and there seems to be even more of this dinosaur going into the hill. So this is a multi-year process to bring this thing out of the ground.
Well, that's the hard work of paleontology, right?
Well, absolutely. It's high-tech and low-tech at the same time. Some of what we do is, you know, newly advanced, and some of what we do is the same as it was in the 19th century.
All right. Well, you read about the hadrosaur. So skin impressions, what were they?
Absolutely. So when this particular dinosaur died, it was rapidly covered by sediment. And rather than preserving the actual skin as sort of like a carbonized film, which sometimes happens, the sandstone formed in such a way that it sort of hardened on top of the skin to leave all these little, almost like pavement of little tubercles and scales. So even though the actual skin is gone, we have basically a mold of that skin. So if we wanted to, we'd even make casts of these things and try and put them in their proper place on this dinosaur.
What are scientists going to learn from seeing that skin?
Well, for one thing, just what dinosaurs look like on the outside. We have a great idea of what they look like on the inside from all the bones. But, you know, this is one of the few ways that we have to see what the actual external sort of covering of dinosaurs actually look like. But beyond that, if you sort of associate skin impressions with different species, you can get an idea, okay, how is skin varying from, you know, between individuals, between possible species? Another way to identify different dinosaur species, perhaps, by correlating this, the skin, with the bones. So this is only just starting to be realized, but, you know, by just this little quirk of preservation, we're getting a few new insights into what dinosaurs are really like.
No feathers on the hadrosaur?
Not as far as have been seen, but that's one of the big questions. Is this the right kind of environment where it might preserve skin impressions, but no feathers? So hadrosaurs, there's been no evidence of fluff or fuzz or feathers on them yet, but distant cousins of theirs on the same side of that dinosaur family tree, archaic cousins of things like Triceratops, so these little horned dinosaurs are about the size of a German Shepherd, had bristles on their tails, and this seems quite similar to archaic feathers. So if you've got birds and all the fuzzy and feathery dinosaurs on one side of the family tree, and you've got these other weirdos with like bristles and quill-like things on the other side of the family tree, there's a possibility that those kind of body coverings were present in the last common ancestor of all dinosaurs. So instead of evolving multiple times, that they're a common trait that was shared, you know, modified in some groups and lost in others. So no one's found any kind of quill or bristle or fuzz on a hadrosaur yet, but it's not outside the realm of possibility either.
Now, the hadrosaur also, we'll come back to the feathers and the like, but the hadrosaur also has the crest, right?
Some of them do. Some of them don't. The neat thing about the ones with the crest, and the particular one that we were excavating.
Bony crest.
On this trip. Yes, a bony hollow crest, sometimes sort of dome-shaped, sometimes jutting out from the back of the skull, all different sort of shapes. It was a visual structure, but it was also an acoustic structure. So paleontologists like David Weisampel at Johns Hopkins actually would create models of these crests and blow into them to see what sounds these dinosaurs could actually make. It's one of the few ways we have of detecting dinosaur sounds. They kind of sounded like a foghorn, these deep, bellowing low-frequency sounds. And if you look at the inner ears of dinosaurs through CT scans, their ears are actually attuned to this exact kind of sound. So these
what dinosaurs, are they looking at? They're looking at the bone structure?
Yeah, the bones of the inner ears. So these little bones that would make up the sort of bony part of the inner ear that allowed the animals to actually hear. So by looking at the structure of these and how they correlated, you know, inside the skull, you can get an idea of like what hearing range they had. And somebody else had done this for a few other dinosaurs, things like Allosaurus, this predator from the Jurassic, or Brachiosaurus, and figured out that for these big dinosaurs, at least their hearing range kind of was so low frequency that the sort of highest that they could hear would be about the range of a human scream. So if you went back into the Jurassic, more or less, you could scream your head off, and the dinosaurs probably couldn't actually hear you. They're attuned to much lower frequencies than we are, which makes sense. They're probably calling to each other over long distances, sort of like what elephants do today. So, you know, if you went back to the Mesozoic and you heard dinosaurs, it'd be more groans and rumbles and bellows.
Brian Switek has written My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. And as you write about the hadrosaur and the science in that, and as you write about largely in this book, new ideas are reshaping our understanding of animals, including your beloved Brontosaurus. What happened to the Brontosaurus?
It's been extinct for, well, scientifically extinct for over a century now. I mean, it was the name that I often saw on museum displays when I was a kid for this long-necked, heavy-bodied, long-tailed dinosaur. But it turned out it was a case of more or less mistaken identity. A particular paleontologist by the name of O.C. Marsh in the late 1800s, he named one animal Apatosaurus. He named another very similar animal Brontosaurus. By 1903, another paleontologist by the name of Elmer Riggs came along and said, no, they're really not that different. They should belong to the same genus. So in 1903, Brontosaurus should have been struck from the scientific record, but for whatever reason, it kind of persisted in museum displays, kind of like a dinosaur ghost in museums in a way. And then it was only in 1975 when the long-lost skull of this animal was finally found that I think that kind of pushed Apatosaurus to the forefront and really, you know, made people realize that they've been using the wrong name for so long.
But you write in the book that the disappearance of the Brontosaurus in popular culture was akin for some people to the eradication of Pluto as a planet. What's going on?
Well, in a way, I mean, Pluto is still out there. It's not a planet anymore. It's a dwarf planet. And the same thing with the bones of, you know, Brontosaurus. The bones are I've actually seen these. They're on display at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History in New Haven. So the bones are still there. We just call them something different now. So it's not as if paleontologists have totally, you know, blown apart, you know, this dinosaur. It's just has a different name and a different bearing and a different attitude than we used to think. It's not the stupid swamp-dwelling monster that it used to be.
Well, is that in part is your point, that these creatures are not just more complex in their behaviors, but also more complex in their structure. And
absolutely.
you have two pictures in here of the Brontosaurus, the Apatosaurus, mm-hmm. as our understanding of it evolved. Can you mm-hmm. compare and contrast those two for me?
Well, absolutely. One of the most important things was lifting that tail off the ground. I mean, for a long time, these dinosaurs were thought to be kind of like overgrown lizards or just overgrown, you know, reptiles of the sort that we'd see around us today. So paleontologists would just have their tails dragging through the mud, you know, but no one ever found trackways with tail drags. And, you know, looking at the osteology, you'd have to break their tails more or less to make this work. So that was one aspect of it. Other parts have to do with just more the arrangement of the bones, making sure their limbs are directly beneath their bodies, not in these sprawled out sort of lizard-like postures. Now there's lifting that neck up, you know, an animal that could browse high in the trees, but also lower its neck to sort of vacuum up vegetation low on the ground. So it's more the secrets that we're getting out of those bones. These might seem like relatively superficial sort of structural changes, but it's understanding, you know, or drawing out the secrets that are kept in those little, you know, prehistoric time capsules. It's really changing our image of what dinosaurs were like. Because previously, paleontologists would reconstruct the skeleton, say, okay, it's a big reptile, found it in a river deposit. It must have just been wallowing in the river, and there wasn't a way to really test this. Now we're finally have methods and techniques to test some of these ideas.
What are those new methods and techniques?
Well, some of it involves actually cutting into the bone itself. You know, histology has really revolutionized paleontology, being able to sort of take a slice out of, say, a Tyrannosaurus femur, a thigh bone, and grind that down so it's really flat. You can see through it and look at these growth rings, basically, when dinosaurs, you know, every year they sort of slow down their growth just so much that it leaves a line almost like a tree ring. You can tell the age of dinosaurs from that. You can tell how fast they're growing at particular parts of their lives. You can even detect pregnant dinosaurs this way. There's a very specific bone tissue called medullary bone. Birds have it, and after all, birds are living dinosaurs, that was present in their non-avian predecessors as well. So if you find this specific bone tissue while I'm looking at these slides, you can tell this female was laying eggs when she died. And therefore, by matching that with age studies, say, you can get an idea, you know, when dinosaurs were reproducing. It turns out that they lived fast and they died young. You know, most dinosaurs were teen moms when they died. And that tells us something about how harsh life must have been in the Mesozoic. So by using techniques like that, by pairing old bones with, you know, these new abilities to look into the bone itself, we're getting these insights into dinosaur biology that I was told that we'd, you know, never, ever get.
When you started doing this, you write, you've talked about yourself as a fanboy, which
yes.
is usually used for, you know, for either a Harry Potter or comic books.
Yes.
What's a fanboy in terms of being a dinosaur aficionado?
Well, it means constantly trying to keep up with the rush of papers. And I mean, personally, going to, you know, any museum or roadside fossil site that I possibly can, you know, finding any excuse to, you know, bring a dinosaur home. I went to an estate sale of the former Utah State paleontologist, James Madison Jr., last year. And my wife told me very specifically, do not bring any dinosaurs home. And instead, I brought home a $400 cast of an Apatosaurus skull. So it's that kind of, you know, affection for dinosaurs.
And what's on your shoulder there?
Dinosaur tattoos as well. So the first one I got is an Allosaurus, which is the Utah State dinosaur. It's based on a specific skeleton from the Cleveland Lloyd Quarry in the eastern part of the state. And then to match it, because I figured it could use some company, I got a Ceratosaurus. So this is another predatory dinosaur from the same quarry, the same formation, another tattoo based upon a very specific skeleton.
What is it? This I can barely tell what it is. You know, because you are attuned, but it's just like it must have come out of the ground, huh? Twisted and turned and laid upon itself?
Yeah, most dinosaurs, when we find them articulated in the field, they're in this classic death pose position where their head is thrown back and their tail is lifted up. In this particular case, this particular Ceratosaurus was not found that complete, I'm sorry to say, but based upon other skeletons, I had a friend of mine, artist Glendon Mello, sort of reconstruct what it would have looked like in this particular pose.
What was the Ceratosaurus? What was its niche?
Well, that's one of the big questions. So during, you know, the classic heyday of the dinosaurs in the late Jurassic in North America.
Which is how many millions years
150
ago?
Million 150 years
million
ago.
Million, yes, okay.
So during this 150 million-year-old really productive time of dinosaur giants, you had, you know, Allosaurus was the big predator on the landscape. That's the most common one. In this particular quarry, there are 46 at least individual Allosaurus specimens from this one place. But Ceratosaurus is also in there, and there's another predator there called Torvosaurus, but they're much rarer. Both Ceratosaurus and Torvosaurus are much more seldom seen. So that's the big question. You have three huge predators living in a landscape with, you know, Stegosaurus and also, you know, the spiky plated dinosaur and up to five different varieties of these large sauropod dinosaurs. It looked like they're food for all, but why is the community so uneven? You know, were they eating different things? Were they, you know, targeting different sorts of prey? Were there just so many dead sauropods that everybody could have a piece? That's one of the ecological questions that paleontologists are still chasing after.
Yeah, they're chasing after a lot. In part, you write, and you said this, non-avian dinosaurs, avian dinosaurs, that
That's
they
right.
split and they're early on. Why do we have the avian dinosaurs on the planet and not the non-avian dinosaurs?
Yeah, why are all the cool ones gone? I mean, no disrespect to ornithologists or birders, but, you know, to me, you know, a chickadee is no substitute for an Apatosaurus or a Tyrannosaurus rex. That's one of the big mysteries, and it's something that I think, you know, we're really only just beginning to understand. I mean, we know that 66 million years ago, you know, an asteroid struck the planet in what is now the Yucatan Peninsula. We know that there was a massive amount of volcanic activity in what is now India. We know the global climate was changing. So we know the sort of murder weapons, if you want to think about this as like the game of Clue almost, but we don't really know the locations and the motivations per se. We don't know how those triggers translated actually to an extinction that not only wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs and left us with the avian ones, but also, you know, decimated, you know, many kinds of lizards and snakes, totally wiped out these coil-shelled cephalopods in the sea called ammonites, you know, various marine reptiles, the flying pterosaurs, they all disappeared. It's not just dinosaurs. It's one of the worst catastrophes in the history of life on Earth, and even many mammal groups. I mean, obviously mammals survived because we're here and we're mammals talking about this, just as, you know, avian dinosaurs did. But determining why someone survived and why someone else perished, it's still a bit of a cold case, really.
You know, when I look at the front of the book and there's the family tree of life, it just is astounding to me. And about how many different kinds of families and there were on this planet and still are. But is it to you as well? I mean, just you said the reptile, the flying reptile. They weren't dinosaurs. They were flying reptiles. They were different,
right, yeah,
different
pterosaurs. Trees. Yeah, yeah. So the closest cousin to dinosaurs on their family tree. It's totally gone.
I mean, when you look at like mammals and that sail-backed creature over
that's
there.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, those aren't dinosaurs either.
The
diversity is insane.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the classic sort of fossil animals that you often get in little packs of dinosaurs if you go to the grocery store or at museums. Dimetrodon, so the sail-backed reptilian-looking animal, it's actually much more closely related to you and I than to any reptile. It goes back to this ancient split between the ancestors of lizards and snakes and dinosaurs and the ancestors of mammals and their closest relatives. And just to look back and see what's been lost, like what we're left with, you know, it's saddening, but it's also just amazing. You know, that's one of the reasons why I love the fossil record, is because as we uncover this, you know, we couldn't imagine these creatures unless we knew they already existed. Basically, they're more fantastic than any dragon or mythological creature that we'd ever think up. And actually, you know, many myths and legends have their basis in fossil discoveries and pre-scientific eras. Legends like, you know, the griffin seem to be based on this little horned dinosaur called Protoceratops found in the Gobi Desert. You know, we've been finding these bones for centuries, and they've been feeding our imaginations before we even had a name for what they were.
What do you want people to still think about when you finish this book? I mean, you wrote this book in part because it was about the new science and all
That's
things
right.
are changing. But what do you want people to think about dinosaurs specifically?
Well, that they're still with us, for one thing, that, you know, birds are living dinosaurs, and that, you know, feathers do not make a dinosaur any less fearsome or wonderful. I mean, that's something I get quite a lot of pushback
it's
against
accepted,
thinking
now,
that,
right?
that
feathers and fuzz are our dinosaurs.
Oh, yes, for many of them, you know, but I often hear when I talk about a fuzzy Tyrannosaurus Rex, people say, you know, you're destroying my childhood memories, which, you know, in a way I am. But kids now, they're on board with this. I want people to think, but more than that, more than just scientific nitty-gritty, that, you know, dinosaurs aren't just kitsch or kid stuff or monsters or nightmare fuel, basically. They're animals that, you know, record, you know, a major expanse in the history of life on Earth. And by studying how they lived, you know, maybe why they went extinct, how they adapted and how they changed, according to, you know, phenomena that are still going on today, climate change, invasive species, things of that nature, they're not just icons of extinction. They may be icons of long-term survival. They may have secrets to share with us about what the future world is going to be like as organisms continue to change according to processes that we're now setting in motion. You know, now we're driving climate change. If we can see how similar sorts of climate change happen naturally in the past, how dinosaurs and other organisms responded to that, that can give us an outline of what might happen in the future. So the past is not a static monument. The past might very well be the key to the future.
Brian Sutick's book is My Beloved Brontosaurus, On the Road with Old Bones, New Science, and Our Favorite Dinosaurs. He writes at the National Geographic, the Laylaps blog, and also Tweeters. What's your Tweeter handle?
My Twitter handle is Laylaps. L-A-E-L-A-P-S.
What is that word?
It's actually the original name for a tyrannosaur that was found in New Jersey before it was found out that it was preoccupied by a kind of blood-sucking owl mite, and the name was changed to Dryptosaurus. But I like Laylaps better, so I decided to go with that one.
A blood-sucking owl mite.
Yes, it depends on what Laylaps means, depends on who you ask.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Steve Scherr. This is Weekday.
.1039. We're going back in time to the golden age of radio in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
I'm Marvin Almy. On the next To the Point, after 3 years in prison, PFC Bradley Manning is finally on trial for admittedly releasing masses of classified information to WikiLeaks. He claims he was performing a public service. Does he deserve a sentence of life without parole for espionage and aiding the enemy? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's this morning at 11 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Pacific Northwest Ballet present Next Step, a choreographic showcase featuring emerging PNB talent and accompanied by the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestras, June 14th at McCaw Hall. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:40. What's for lunch? We'll find out in 10 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
During the golden age of radio, the airwaves were full of regular radio shows. Some went on for decades. Katie Sewell, I'm Steve Scherr. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
All right, so they went on for decades and...
Yeah, a few lucky actors got those reoccurring roles. But as you know, as people grow and change throughout their lives, or executives get different ideas, or people die, rather than canceling a popular show, actors were replaced by someone new playing exactly the same part.
Huh. Yeah. Well, all right. That
makes sense. For example, Orson Welles was the first person to play the Shadow.
What good will it do you to kill me if you also die?
Followed by Bill Johnstone until 1943, but it was Brett Morrison who held the role the longest.
This is the Shadow, Roger Lash.
The Shadow?
You couldn't burn down a cordon of men, Roger Lash.
Oh, I could, I could.
Your power is ebbing.
Power is ebbing.
Yes. So for today's radio retrospective, weekday producer Jason Pagano suggested that we take a couple of these shows that have a revolving central character, and we ask the question, who played that character best?
Really?
Now, this is purely subjective, of course. So if you're at home or at work, play along. We'll see if you agree with what Steve picks as the best actor.
Oh, so these are my picks, huh?
You're gonna be the decider on the radio.
All right.
But, like, of course, play along at home or at work, and you can send emails and we'll see if you agree.
Good. It's very good.
Let's start with the private detective, Sam Spade. The famous mystery writer Dashiell Hammett created Sam Spade for his novel The Maltese Falcon, which was made into a movie multiple times. Most remembered movie version of that was the third take, Humphrey Bogart playing Sam Spade. On the radio, though, it was Edward G. Robinson who was the first to play the role in 1943 for Lux Radio Theater.
What do you know about this killing, Spade?
Very little.
Archie was your partner, wasn't he?
That's right.
Spade and Archie, private detective. I guess you'll have to change that name.
Yeah. Now on, it's just Sam Spade.
Yeah. You don't seem very broken up over this, Spade. Miles Archie got shot dead 2 hours ago, and you toss it off like a scotch and soda.
Oh, excuse me. Will you have one, Lieutenant?
No, I won't.
Okay, mind if I have one, Lieutenant?
No.
You don't like me, do you, Dandy?
I don't like any cops who aren't on the force.
I didn't even know Edward G. Robinson had done Sam Spade on Lux Radio Theater.
I know. Well, the second to make the radio appearance was Humphrey Bogart. He did the role two times, once in 1943 for the Screen Guild Theater production, and again in 1946 for the Academy Award Theater.
Miles hadn't many brains, but he had too many years' experience as a detective to be caught like that by a man he was shadowing up a blind alley with his gun tucked away in his hip and his overcoat buttoned. But he'd have gone up there with you, Angel. He was just dumb enough for that. And then you could have stood as close to him in the dark as you liked and put a bullet through him.
Don't talk like that to me, Sam. You know I didn't
know.
Stop
it. Why did you shoot him?
So that's Humphrey Bogart. And in 1946, the networks decided to stop limiting Sam Spade to the story of the Maltese Falcon, and a new radio show was created called The Adventures of Sam Spade. Howard Duff was the one that was hired to play the leading role.
Effie?
Say what you have to say and I'll go.
You've been through a tough time, sweetheart.
Well, you didn't make it any easier.
You think it was a cakewalk for me? You think my nerves are made of rubber?
You have no nerves. You're just a cold, callous
Shut
old
up.
Detective.
You're going to listen to me. You're going to sit still, not talk, and listen. I've finished, you can say goodnight or goodbye.
And that radio show lasted for some time on the air. It was on from 1946 to 1951. So now it's decision time. Steve, who played it best? Well, Edward G. Robinson, Humphrey Bogart, or Howard Duff?
So I listened to Sam Spade still. You can find him.
Yes.
He's around. Though usually you have to pay for the Sam Spade shows because the folks that grabbed up all the copyrights are still charging for it. But he's out there. And I've listened to a lot of them. And Howard Duff is great.
He is great.
He's a lot of fun. He's great. But it's Bogart.
You got to give it to him.
It's Bogart because Bogart took that character. I mean, you could hear it in Duff. Even in this one, you chose a good example. He's still tough. He's still hard as nails, but not the way Bogart was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bogart took that character and made it so dark and so, like there is a pit you go down when you listen to Bogart's voice that you think, wow, there's a lot of stuff has made this guy the way he is. So
that's good. And, you know, it's funny because the original description of what Sam Spade was supposed to look like is like a blonde guy. And Bogart played it so well in the movies that everybody pictured him like a dark-haired, you know, chain-smoking guy.
Well, I think a little more like Howard Duff. And if you read some of the early novels, a little more like Howard Duff.
Exactly.
But I listen to it, I say Bogart.
All right, let's try another one.
All right, I'm ready.
The Lone Ranger. A lot of people played the Lone Ranger really, really, really briefly. So we're going to just focus on the two actors that held the role the longest, starting out with Earl Grazer. He played the role for 8 years, from 1933 to 1941.
Pardon me.
Who
What is it, stranger?
I've heard that Ritter was a dangerous outlaw and the leader of a large gang.
That's what's generally known about him.
Why, then, was he given only 60 days in jail?
So we could give him to stand the peace.
Is that why he was jailed?
That's right.
Didn't you jail any of his men?
Nope. We never had nothing against him.
I see.
So that was a clip from the very last time he played the Lone Ranger. Now, I don't want to influence who you think played it best, Steve, by telling you this little detail, but Earl Grazier didn't leave the role. He was killed unexpectedly in a car accident, which was not only shocking and sad, it was a problem for a weekly radio show. How can you go on without your title character while you're still trying to find someone to fill the role? So we're going to step aside for just a moment because I thought it would be fun for you to hear how they dealt with it.
The Lone Ranger's going to ride again.
Where him now?
He's in my house.
What matter?
Shot and hurt bad. He got mixed up in a range war. Now listen, Tonto, before you go inside. Don't let him talk too long. He's bad and need a rest, and he's been fighting off sleep, hoping you'd come here.
There were 5 episodes where Tonto was the main character. And if the Lone Ranger appears at all, he only whispers or he talks in a very raspy voice.
I'm glad to hear Tonto had some starring roles, character.
Well, Bruce Beamer was the man selected to take over for the Lone Ranger role. He was already working on the show at the time. He was the announcer. And he was also the one making public appearances as the Lone Ranger because the station owner thought he looked more like the part.
Was that right? That's very funny.
Yeah. So he ended up taking over, and he played the role until the show ended in 1954. This is the very first episode he appeared in, so his character is still on the mend, remember?
Where's Silver?
Oh, him follow behind. Him wait for master.
That's my horse.
Him hear your voice, eh?
Tonto, I'm going to be able to ride the big white fellow again soon.
All right, so there you go. Who played it better?
Well, I'd never heard the other guy.
Oh.
I had never heard him before, and he sounds pretty good. I would have said Bruce Beamer. Bruce Beamer, just because he's the only one I'd ever really heard.
But Earl Grazier.
I kind of like the way Earl Grazier sounds. My one problem with Bruce Beamer.
It's a hard name.
It does this thing with his nose that always kind of bothered me. But I'll give it to Bruce just because I know him better.
All right.
So I think people have to weigh in on that. And then, of course, you have to go to the TV show, too.
Yeah. But we're not judging the TV show. So, but yeah, weigh in if you like the first guy earlier.
In my head, Clayton Moore, he was the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
So they all had very similar voices, though, which is interesting.
Well, I think they're imitating a certain kind of voice.
Yeah,
because even
right.
The people who were on very, very briefly sound almost exactly the same. All right, let's do one more, shall we?
Yes.
Let's do it really rapid fire this time.
Right.
No more long scenes.
All right.
You get to hear one line. That's it. Our favorite radio show, our favorite radio insurance investigator, Johnny Dollar. Both of us love this show. He was played on the air by 4 people. We're going to listen to them all really quick. So the first one was Charles Russell.
Expense account submitted by investigator Johnny Dollar. 2, Home Office, East Coast Underwriters, Terminal Building, Hartford, Connecticut.
The next one was Edmund O'Brien.
Expense account item 2, miscellaneous, while in Los Angeles, $255.08. Item 3, same as item 1, transportation back to Hartford.
Back to Hartford, he was going to say.
Yeah, he was. That third was John Lund.
A man could afford to buy that much life insurance, but he couldn't buy himself a hamburger?
Interested?
Very.
And the final Johnny Dollar was played by Bob Bailey.
Johnny Dollar.
Pat Gallagher at Universal. How'd you make out with Miss Reardon?
I met her. She thinks I'm an insurance broker or something.
Now, wait, I thought there's one more after Bob Bailey.
Nope. You're thinking of Dick Powell.
Right, because he did the auditions.
He did the audition.
That's right.
He was never on the air, though. This is the comparison of the people on the air.
All right, well, there's no question. I mean, I
Charles Russell, Edmund O'Brien, John Lund, Bob Bailey.
It's Bob Bailey.
It's
Bob Bailey because I know Charles Russell did it for quite a long time, right?
Yes.
And Edmund O'Brien did it at the beginning for pretty good chunk of time.
Yeah, a few, like 3-4 years.
Yeah. But just Bob Bailey has that snarky quality, which I don't think you hear that in performances of leading characters until now. You know, now again we have sort of characters who are snarky or a little brittle, a little pushy on TV. None come to mind, but thinking about it, but doctor characters often are that way now. So there's a little more personality to them. They're not all goody-goody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Bob Bailey because he kind of harkens back not to the depth of Sam Spade, but to this sort of, you know, hard-bitten, hard-drinking, kind of cavalier, but in the end, sensitive.
Yeah, he also has more nuance to him in the way he plays it. He's not just, you know, being the hard-boiled insurance investigator.
That's right.
You know, he's also making jokes and being light here and there.
That's right. That's true.
Yeah. So I would have to agree with you on that one. But maybe people at home feel differently.
So you want people to write?
Yeah, write. Tell me who you like.
Are you going to put this on Facebook so people can vote?
Sure, why not?
I think you should. And for the other ones, or Johnny Dollar, Charles Russell, Edmund O'Brien, John Lund, Bob Bailey. Also, I'm curious what people think about Clayton Moore as Lone Ranger.
Yeah, good point.
Fun game.
Thanks for coming in to play.
All right, we'll do it again. This is Weekday.
And I guess as we're thinking about Johnny Dollar, he should win just because he has a good name. It is Thursday. It is almost summertime. And food writer Sarah Dickerman, we're doing a little Spanish thing today.
Yeah, we are. We're going to go to Chico Madrid, which is a new sandwich shop on the west side of Capitol Hill. And it's a really sweet little spot. I think one of the things I like about it is just that it's just sort of this right size, cozy place. The center of it is a horseshoe-shaped bar that's covered with nice red tile, and there's little here and there mementos of Madrid. And the specialty of the place is bocadillos, which are Spanish sandwiches that you'll find almost anywhere you go. If you go into a bar, you might see some already made on the counter that you can pick up. They're filled with lots of delicious, they're pretty simple sandwiches, but filled with delicious salty bits. So you might get, the bread might be moistened. A lot of the sandwiches here, the bread is moistened with a little bit of tomato pulp in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, I noticed that tomato pulp.
Yeah.
Was that like
so
ketchup?
In the middle of the summer, they might just rub a fresh tomato across the bread. It's just moist, fresh tomato, basically. It's not processed, it's not cooked. So it's very fresh, that bursting tomato aroma inside something. And then it's usually contrasted with something like Manchego cheese or chorizo or serrano ham. So the sandwiches here all have that nice contrast of sort of sweet tomato taste, the, you know, deliciously rich olive oil on the bread, and then a little bite of something quite sharp.
What?
And they do also do hot sandwiches, which are called bikinis, which is just funny.
like it's like a bikini bathing suit name. So that must mean something in Spanish, and I don't know what that is.
I should have looked it up. Could also just mean that, you know, it's kind of so hot you might wear it, you know, goes along with the beach, right?
Yeah, that's it. And these are, they're, some of them are savory, but they're not all. They're you have one in particular that you like, which is essentially peanut butter and jelly in the Spanish idiom.
Yes, it is. So first of all, let me say that I am a huge peanut butter and jelly junkie. Despite the fact that I like more complicated lunches, sometimes if I don't have time, I'll often have one, and I just love changing up my jellies. So in this case, they make it with almond butter, and then they use membrillo, which is the quince paste, which is like a quince jam that's been cooked until it's quite thick and jellied, and you slice it, and it goes. I mean, it's a brilliant pairing with Manchego cheese itself, but they do a hot almond butter and quince paste sandwich that I think is just terrific. And then the co-owner, Franz Gilbertson, is the owner of Honoré Bakery over in Ballard, and so they also have some really nice pastries, including a lemony olive oil cake called a Magdalena that I enjoyed. It's a fun place to.
Yeah, now that cake sounds worth the trip. The restaurant is called Chico Madrid. They actually also have breakfast, I noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these things seem like they taste just as good in the morning or at this time of day. You also wanted to talk about not so much a cookbook today, but essentially sort of the history of food and 100 recipes.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a book by William Sitwell. It's published in... England, I think, last year or the year before, and it's now coming out with an American edition. And it does, in fact, have a recipe or something like akin to a recipe at the head of every chapter. But basically, it's this great book to poke through and open up and read a different chapter here and there. And it's organized chronologically. It's the history of Western civilization and food. So it starts with Egyptian bread making and goes all the way on to Heston Blumenthal, who's a very modern British chef. But along the way, you come across really interesting stories, like this guy who wrote perhaps the first vegetarian cookbook in English, John Evelyn, who was around during the time of the Cromwell's Revolution. And, is one of the first people to advocate eating raw salads in the Roman time. There was some hesitation to eat raw vegetables, or you learn about the history of sandwiches or, also sort of funny pop things like Rice Krispie treats and TV chefs. And it's just a really fun cookbook that sort of gets at the gestalt of cooking in a given era. And I find I've been really enjoying popping through it.
The book is called A History of Food in 100 Recipes, and the author is William Sitwell, just like it sounds, Sitwell. Sarah Dickerman is our food writer extraordinaire. You can find her at Slate, New York Times, Bon Appetit, online at sarahdickerman.com and at Sarah Dickerman on Twitter. And right now, I hope you're enjoying a vacation. You're on the East Coast, so...
I am. I'm in Cape Cod.
And so you should be eating things like lobster and boiled potatoes and all those specialties, and then you can come back and tell us about it.
I will do. Have a great weekend and eat well.
Yeah, thanks so much, and you have a great rest of your vacation. That's Sarah Dickerman, always a guest on Thursdays here on Weekday on KUOW. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with our state attorney general, Bob Ferguson. I got a bunch of legal questions to talk to him about, and then our panel of journalists will be in as well. A little biotech journalism as well with Luke Timmerman. So it's all coming up. We hope you can join us on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
69 degrees and sunny in Seattle. We're going to get up to a toasty 77 this afternoon. Now, the forecast for much of Florida is for heavy rain, gusty winds, rough surf, and severe thunderstorms. Tropical Storm Andrea in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from United Way of King County, joining with the Seattle Mariners for an all-star celebrity softball classic for homeless youth on June 15th at Safeco Field. More information at unitedwayofkingcounty.org.
Some places it's not about predicting conflict, it's more about wondering how long it can go on.
At the moment, the situation in the Middle East is just so volatile with everything shifting. It's like a major earthquake and you don't quite know when it's going to stop.
Volatility in Syria and Turkey, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Fry Art Museum, presenting Buster Simpson, Surveyor, the first career retrospective exhibition of the Seattle artist working in the field of urban environmentalism and art in public spaces. Opening June 15th. Details online at frymuseum.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.